Tonight, we're very pleased to have Mark Zimmer with us. He's going to discuss his book, Illuminating Disease, An Introduction to Green Fluorescent Particles. He's written two other books. One is Bioluminescence, Nature and Science at Work, which I think was just published this year, right? And an earlier book called Glowing Genes, A Revolution in Biotechnology, that was published in 2005. His work has also appeared in the LA Times, USA Today, and Huffington Post. He's a professor at Connecticut College in Connecticut. It's a wonderful, small, liberal arts college that has a long, rich tradition, and he exemplifies all the things that we admire most in professors. He's a great scholar, teacher, mentor, and he involves students in research so that by the time many of them graduate, they have published an article, they've been to a national meeting, made a presentation, or had a poster presentation. And some of those things have been recognized. In 2007, he was named Connecticut Professor of the Year by the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education and the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. He was program chair for the Inorganic Division of the American Chemical Society for 4 years and won the John S. Burlew Connecticut Valley Section Award in recognition of his outstanding contributions to chemistry. Grew up in South Africa, wanted to be a game warden, went to college, couldn't remember the names of the animals, or was it the plants? The plants. So he switched to chemistry, and somehow he could remember all those darn things in chemistry that many of us would like to forget. His mother had wanted him to be a doctor. After he graduated in South Africa, he came to the United States, went to Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, got his PhD there, and then went to Yale for a postdoc. And he has quite a remarkable record. He's been at Connecticut College now for 26 years, distinguished record of publication and students and service. So it's all those things that we hear about in universities that you should be evaluated by: your research, your teaching, and your public service. And he's a straight A student across all three. Please welcome Mark Zimmer.
So I'm a computational chemist. I use big computers to calculate the shapes of molecules. And then from the shapes, I try and figure out what properties do these molecules have. And the main property I'm interested in is giving off light. So look at big proteins and how they give off light. And then I use the computer to try and calculate how I can change something in that protein and make it give off light of a different color, or a brighter light, or maybe a light that is green and I shine another color on it and it changes color. That's what I'm looking for, and I'm trying to calculate that. Yep, okay, it just delayed a little. Okay. Smooth. If you go into the second floor here and you go and look at the jellyfish, you'll see an exhibit that's got the crystal jellyfish, or Cora Victoria. And that's one of the proteins that I'm interested in, is the one that's responsible for this green light here. When you go and look at the jellyfish, it's probably not going to light up. It's got the 300 to 350 photo organs that you see there under a microscope all around this umbrella. And it just lights up occasionally. So if you're looking up there, you probably won't see it light up. But we're very interested to see how this works. So if you agitate it, it releases calcium. That calcium binds to another protein that's named after the jellyfish. It's called aquarin. And if you do this in a test tube, you get a flash of blue light. But if you look at the jellyfish, there's no blue light. So something else is happening in this jellyfish, and that's the fact that there's another protein that's there that's called green fluorescent protein. I guess for St. Patrick's Day, we've got a green protein here. What this green protein does It absorbs the blue light energy, so that's actually never given off, and then gives it off as green light. So it just sucks up that blue light energy, gives it off as green light. There's the green fluorescent protein, and then if we look at the next part, we'll see it gives off that green light. The protein that's responsible for that, for absorbing the blue light and then giving off green light, looks like this. It's got this, we call it a beta barrel. So it's a barrel with all of these sheets, and right in the middle is what we call the fluorophore. And the fluorophore, yeah. Now I feel comfortable again. So the light comes here, it hits this fluorophore, absorbs all the blue light, and then gives it back immediately as green light. The reason it absorbs blue light is because blue light travels the furthest in water. And so all marine organisms, if they give off light to communicate, they typically give off blue light, because other organisms can see that really far away. If they're excited by light, they're normally excited by blue light. So this is excited by blue light. Another way of looking at it is saying it looks a bit like a soda can. In the middle is this chromophore. And this chromophore is made up of an amino acid called tyrosine. Looks like this. And so one of the very first things that people did when we knew that this is what green fluorescent protein looked like is just change this one amino acid, just this one here, to another one that's very similar. For example, this, I thought it would be there. It's not there. So you can change it to something called histidine, and then it becomes a blue fluorescent protein. Here we can see why I'm interested in this protein. This is a depiction of DNA, right? DNA codes, has the recipe how to make a protein. And so if this protein needs to be made, for example, I scratch my eye, and my eye wants to repair itself, the cells around it start making proteins to repair that scratch. There's something called a promoter that turns on this recipe, this gene, and then it starts reading this information, which is the information how to make the protein. At the end, there's something called a stop codon. The stop codon really says, stop, this is the end of the gene. Now, what you could do is you could go to a jellyfish, and in the jellyfish, find the gene for green fluorescent protein, the recipe how to make green fluorescent protein. Take that from the jellyfish and sneak it at the end of this recipe for this protein. Now, when this protein needs to be made, it reads the recipe. There should be a stop here, but there isn't. There's just the recipe how to make green fluorescent protein. So then when this protein's made, green fluorescent protein will be hanging off it. Now you can shine a blue light on the cell. As soon as this is made, it glows green. If this moves, you can see where it goes to. So now we've got a way of taking proteins which are incredibly small that we can't see even with a microscope and seeing them. It's a bit like if you've got a firefly flying very, very far away. If it flashes at night, you'll see it. During the day, you wouldn't see it. The light you can see very easily. You can't see this protein, but we can see the light that it gives off. And then when it moves, we can see where it goes to. Here's the slide that's snuck in behind here. Change this tyrosine to a histidine, and you got blue fluorescent proteins. You can also go back to nature. And remember, the green fluorescent protein came from a jellyfish. Well, I calculate how we can change these proteins to give different colors. Biologists go back into the ocean and they look for other species that have these fluorescent proteins. And so I have friends who go scuba diving, and they go really deep at night in the dark with blue lights and shine their blue lights at everything and try to see, does anything fluoresce? If it does, they'll take a small sample take it to the lab and try and find the DNA for the fluorescent protein. More than 120 different species have found that fluoresce. So it's not just the jellyfish. Corals fluoresce. Now the jellyfish makes its own light, because remember it had that thing called a quorin, which made the blue light. It's like having your flashlight. It's got its own flashlight, it makes the blue light, and then the green fluorescent protein changes it to green. Corals don't have that, they just have the fluorescent protein, so you shine a blue light on it, you'll see it glow, but it doesn't make its own light. Here we can see this is a petri dish, and these are E. coli bacteria that have all been genetically modified with different colors of fluorescent proteins. So this is a green fluorescent protein from the jellyfish, this is red fluorescent protein from a coral, this is a modified one in which they changed the one tyrosine to a histidine, and it glows blue. So this is just sort of to show you that green fluorescent proteins are incredibly useful. So in 2004, a long, long time ago, but that's the last time somebody really did an analysis of this time, if you looked at the Journal of Cell Biology, 60% of the papers used GFP or fluorescent proteins to do their experiments. So that's 60% of the experiments in cell biology use this little tag, this little flashlight that you tie to a protein to see when a protein's made and where it goes to. In the UK, if you genetically modify anything, you have to apply for, you go on the web, if it's bacteria, and you just fill out a form. If it's anything bigger than bacteria, you actually have to go before a university board. So we know how many experiments are done, done in the UK, and in 2009, 1.2 million experiments were done using GFP. So it's used a lot. So when I started working on fluorescent proteins back in 1994, there were four papers that had been published about GFP. My first paper was the fifth paper ever published. So here in California, you know, we talk about surfing and stuff. I like to sort of use the analogy of research as a bit like surfing. I caught this wave right at the beginning. And if you catch a wave in the beginning, you've got sort of rights. And so that's really been very nice. Because it worked so well, I've carried on doing this GFP research. Teaching at a liberal arts college or any college is great most of the time. But there are a couple of things that none of us like. One of them is grading. And the other one is writing letters of recommendation. They're so important, right? Because you need a good letter of recommendation to go to grad school or do something like that. So I know it's important, and I've got to write many of them. And so I don't like writing them much. So a long time ago, a student of mine came to me and said, could you please write a letter of recommendation for me? I want to go on this program semester at sea. I said, okay, what's it all about? Well, it's a cruise ship. I was like, yeah, okay. And we go around the world. And you'll like this. We're going to Cape Town, South Africa, and I know that's where you go a lot. And I said, yeah, but this is, what's the study part? And she said, no, I promise you, it's a floating university. It goes around the world. Wherever it stops, students can go and have 5 days of freedom. And then every day the ship is traveling, you have classes. And I said, yeah, come on. But I was good. I wrote the letter of recommendation. She went on the semester at sea program. She came back a semester later, and I asked her about it. And I said to myself, well, I'm never writing another letter of recommendation for this place unless I get to go. And so, you know, I was set on going. The only problem was, in order to teach on this boat, you have to teach a course that deals about all the ports you go to. So the trip I wanted to go to went down the Amazon to Manaus in Brazil, across to Ghana, to South Africa, to Mauritius, India, and then carried on. So I had to find three courses that were about what I could teach, chemistry, and these different ports. So I normally teach an environmental chemistry class. So that was easy. You just teach about all the environmental problems in all these places. Then another one I taught was a sort of chemistry for poets, for people who didn't really want to do science, and it was all about the chemistry of the ocean. And then I came up with another one, which was about diseases. How can you use green fluorescent proteins to study diseases? And for each port, I was going to talk about a different disease. So we went down to Manaus, and Chagas disease is very common there. So all the way to Manaus, students learned about Chagas disease and how we could use fluorescent proteins. We went across to Ghana, malaria. South Africa, unfortunately, HIV/AIDS. India, dengue fever. Vietnam, cancer. China, cancer as well. In Vietnam, mainly because of Agent Orange, cancer because of incredible high amounts of smoking. But then Japan, heart disease, and then we went back to America and the brain and how you can use some of the students who I've spoken to before, how you can use light to see what's happening in the brain and how you can control the brain with light. So that was my idea of the voyage. What I'm going to do is give you a couple of tastes of parts of the class. I'm going to start with heart disease. We all know about heart disease, right? It's pretty common. And so let's talk about some experiments you can do using fluorescent proteins to look at heart disease. So when you think about the heart, what do you think about? Anybody got some, what's the first sort of one or two word thought you get about the heart? Circulation, blood pressure, much beating, yeah. Yeah, beating is what I was looking for. Okay, so what controls the beating of your heart? So hundreds and hundreds of years ago, people thought, well, it's probably your brain. But it turns out it's not your brain. There are all kinds of experiments, right? And we know chickens, you can cut their heads off and they run around for a long time with their hearts still beating. We know the term brain dead. Brain dead, the brain's no longer working, but the heart is still beating and it carries on beating. It can carry on beating for a long, long time, for months. So the question really is, what is controlling the beat of the heart? So this is a fairly old paper from 2005. And this group knew that in humans, there was a protein or two that controlled something called ultradian rhythms, rhythms that occur very often in a day. So there's circadian rhythms, which are your rhythms when you wake up and when you sleep. These are the ones that occur very, very quickly. So they knew there were these proteins that sort of acted like a watch, and they controlled these beatings. But you can't go into a human and mess with somebody's proteins and change them genetically and see what happens. So you need model systems. And this is a great model system. It's called C. elegans. It's a little worm. We have 10 to the 15 cells in the human body. That's 10 with 15 zeros. That's how many cells we have in our body. If we look at each of those cells, just getting off on a tangent, each of those cells has about this much DNA. If we take this much DNA times 10 to the 15, it takes us from here to the sun and back 49 times. Just to give you how many cells we have. It's incredibly difficult to study that many cells. This little worm, when it's mature, 949 cells. All the C. elegans in the world, 949 cells. So it's much easier to study, okay? It's the first organism that its whole genome was sequenced. So we know the DNA sequence of this worm. So we sort of have the recipe book. We don't know what all the individual recipes do, but we have the book. So what these researchers did, they looked at the proteins in humans and said, this is the recipe for humans. Is there a similar recipe, a similar gene, in the genome, the recipe book of this worm? And yes, there was. There was one protein that looked very, very similar. So, because this is GFP talk, what they did is they tagged that protein with GFP. And this is the resulting worm. It glows in three places. So we know that this protein that's very similar to the one in humans is found here, here, and here. What does they do? Well, you get this really cool technique called knockout technique, and you can knock out this protein just here. So it's made there, and it's made there, but not there. And then you can knock it out here, so it's made there and there. And so you can see, what does this protein do? So you go to the area which is around its digestive area, and you go and knock out this green fluorescent protein with this probably thymine molecule. What happens to your worm? Well, normally your worm, this is, how often do you think it has a bowel movement? Every morning. That would be a severely constipated worm. You're going to have to go more frequent than that. Any better offers? Every 3 hours, better offer than that. Come on. Quicker, quicker. Quicker.
Every 10 minutes.
Less.
Every second.
Every about 10 to 20 seconds. So it's got an active digestive system. If you knock out this thymine protein around its digestive system, the grown worm only grows to that size. Normally it should grow to this size. And guess what? It's severely constipated. Instead of going to the bathroom every 10 seconds, it goes every 10 minutes. It's like you're not going to be able to go to the bathroom for a couple of months. So it's also, its growth is compromised. It turns out this makes sense, because when we digest food, our stomach has little villi that move the food around, and they also have very rhythmic contractions that are perhaps regulated by a thymine mechanism. So that sounds as if it makes sense. Let's go and knock out another area. This is the area around the mouth. How much saliva do you think we make a day? You can see this talk is designed for high school and middle school kids. We make about a gallon, about 2 liters of saliva a day. And you don't know this, but you're continuously swallowing that saliva, because otherwise you'd drown. So even at 3 in the morning, when you're fast asleep, just like your heart beats, you're swallowing that saliva. It's a rhythmic ultradian rhythm. This worm, when you take it away, can't do that, and it's dead. It drowns in its own saliva. Last part, the sex lives of C. elegans. Pretty interesting. C. elegans are tiny little worms, okay? They're barely as big as an exclamation mark in a book. They live in very dense conditions where they're all on top of each other in sort of muddy bacterial environments. That's what they like to eat. They're great to study because they've got so few cells, and because if you put them in a fridge, everything stops. Their growth, all their biochemical rhythms stop. Take them out, it starts up again. And so you can stop your experiment for the weekend and come back, and it starts again as if you haven't stopped it. So they're really cool experimental animals. Now, their sex lives. 99.9% of C. elegans are hermaphrodites. They're both male and female, and they self-fertilize. So the male, when the eggs are fertile, and only when the eggs are fertile, sends its sperm to the egg, and the egg gets fertilized, and you've got a new C. elegans. 99.9% is still less than 1%, and those are just males. They're no females. And what happens is sometimes the sperm runs out. So it's a hermaphrodite, used up all their sperm, they've still got fertile eggs, and that's where that less than 1% males come about. They supply the sperm for the ones that have run out of sperm. So what happens if you mess with this protein? Well, remember I said the sperm is only released when the eggs are fertile? Timing. Guess what happens to the sperm? The sperm just goes and flies across whenever it thinks it wants to, and there's no timing, and the hermaphrodite worm runs out of sperm very, very quickly. So now the really interesting thing that happens is evolution. Within a day, there'll be 98% of hermaphrodites, 2% of males. Within about 3 weeks, you'll have 50% hermaphrodites and 50% males supplying that extra sperm that they've run out of. So this was done at the University of Utah, and they have a public relations department that came out with this PR thing, and I loved the title, Rhythm Gene Discovered. You can see that, right? The scoop on when worms poop, ovulate, and swallow. Just the scientific paper, I should actually have the title underneath it, is long and boring, and you wouldn't know what it's about. But that's what it's about. Okay, so that was in 2005. It's a cool experiment, because what it shows you is we have this protein that we think does something like about timing in a human. We go and look for that similar one based on the genetic structure in the worm. We find it. We take this jellyfish protein and we can see what it does. And then we try and say, oh yeah, okay, can we take it back to humans? Well, a little bigger than a little worm is a mouse. Now you can go and take these same proteins and look, do mice have these proteins? And indeed they do. And in fact, they've got it so far now that you can take this protein that's found in mice, make two mutations, so change two amino acids, and then you'll have a mouse that has an arrhythmic heartbeat. So we can see that this gene determines in humans probably as well, because mice and humans are very, very similar, that this is responsible for controlling our heartbeat. Now, this worm, 959 cells, 60% of its genome is the same as humans. It's crazy. It's so similar. And so it's a very, very useful model organism. So these fluorescent proteins are very useful. So people are always trying to find new ones. A group in Japan went diving with the blue light, and they found this stony coral. They shone a blue light on it. In the dark, it glows green. And you would, just where you'd expect, these parts here glow green. They then went and extracted the DNA for the gene, expressed it in bacteria, so the bacteria were making this protein, and put it lying next to the window and went away for the weekend. When the student came back, he found that the bacteria that were closest to the window had changed color, whereas the ones that had stayed in the dark were green, and they changed to red. So here was a fluorescent protein, which is normally green, but if you shine an intense light on it, it'll change to a sort of reddish pink color. So that's pretty useful. So let's see how we can use this. Of course, we're still talking about hearts. So let's talk about heart attacks. So when a heart attack happens, is one of the things that happens is the oxygen isn't brought to the heart anymore because the heart stops beating. And with no oxygen, the heart cells start dying. In humans, once a heart cell has died, we call a heart cell a cardiomyocyte. Once the cardiomyocyte has died, it doesn't come back. So that damage is permanent. In zebrafish, if a zebrafish has had a heart attack, it comes back. They regenerate. So people wanted to study this. How does the zebrafish regenerate heart muscles? I like this drawing. So this is 2012, group from University of Minnesota. Here, those eyes, the eyes of the zebrafish. Okay, so we're missing the tail here. We all know that's a heart, right? And we all know that the heart doesn't really look like that. But you can see the color, right? It's been genetically modified, and it's been genetically modified with a protein from this coral, and this protein has been called Keda. It's Japanese for autumn. And because it changes from green to red. Okay, so here's your fish. You take an intense blue light, and you shine it on this circle, and then it'll turn red where you've shone the light. If you do nothing, that red dot will stay like that, defined. What that's telling you is that the proteins in the circle aren't moving, so there's no movement of cells from here into there or from there out. So everything's just staying the same. Then you go and damage the heart. You don't take a pair of scissors, but you cut off part of the heart. Now the heart is damaged, and what happens is cells from this area, the red dots, and cells from that area fix the heart. So now we can see, where do the cells come from, the stem cells that are fixing the heart? We can see they come from both areas. And we can also see they're not active if there's no damage. To show you what this looks like, here's the fish heart. Here's that circle where you shine the intense light on it. And then here you can see how it's fixed it again. This is my favorite experiment. I lied to you a few seconds ago when I said that humans can't regenerate stem cells, heart cells. There's one segment of the population that can, and that is pregnant women. Pregnant women have more heart attacks than you'd imagine, because you can imagine this baby is pushing on the heart, and there's quite a lot of stuff happening. But if a woman who's pregnant has a heart attack, and she survives, most of that damage will be fixed. So Hina Chaudhry, a cardiologist at Mount Sinai, had this crazy idea. She thought to herself, what happens if somebody who's not pregnant has a heart attack? There's a heart attack, and there's a chemical signal given off. And this chemical signal is sent to molecule. It's sent all over the whole body. And it basically says, oh, crap. Help me, heart attack, come and fix me. But there's nothing in the body to fix the heart attack, and nothing happens. What happens in a pregnant woman? She has the heart attack. The molecule gets sent all over her body. Somehow, highly unlikely, goes across the placenta to the embryo. The embryo releases embryonic stem cells. They go into the bloodstream of the mother, and they go all the way to the heart, because of course the blood goes to the heart, and there is the source of the distress signal, and they differentiate and become heart muscle cells, and they fix the heart. So how do you prove this? The experiment is so darn easy. So Jerry knows that I used to have green fluorescent mice as pets. So you can take a normal mouse and a green fluorescent mouse. And the mother is wild type, no fluorescence, nothing fluoresces. The male is green fluorescent. You mate them. While the female's pregnant, you can actually shine a blue light on her stomach. And you should see about half the offspring will be fluorescent, and the other half won't be. If you don't do anything, she'll give birth to these little mice. Half will be fluorescent, half of them won't be fluorescent. And if you go and look at the female after she's given birth, nothing fluorescent. Okay. Now do the same experiment, but while the female's pregnant, you induce a heart attack. People can start thinking what's going to happen, right? She has the heart attack, she sends the message out, the molecule goes across the placenta, somehow embryonic stem cells go to the heart, they differentiate, but those cells will be green fluorescent. So now if you go and look at the mother after the heart attack, you should find green fluorescent cells, one place only, in her heart. Here's the result. Okay, so here first as a sort of cartoon, here's the enhanced green fluorescent embryo. It has some embryonic stem cells. They've got the distress message. It goes through the blood system and goes to the heart, differentiates in the heart. And here you can see actual fluorescent microscope images. And you can see some of the cardiomyocytes have green fluorescence, some of the smooth muscles and the endothelial cells. So she was right. That's exactly what happens. Now, there has been some evidence of this before, because it turns out that all of the women who've been pregnant have some DNA from their husbands in them. And what happens is that we've seen this in mice. If the mice are pregnant and have some injury, knock on the head or anything like that, often embryonic stem cells from the mouse will come, from the embryo will come and fix that. So it seems to happen quite often, and there's no reason to think it doesn't happen in humans. But it's an incredibly simple experiment to conceptualize. To do, it's a little harder, but not that hard. That's why I like this one, and because, of course, it's actually an amazing concept to think that this is happening. Okay, malaria. So malaria, we can see worldwide fatalities in 2010, just over 500,000. Thanks to Bill Gates and the Bill Gates Foundation, it's dropping. It used to be quite a lot more than 1 million. We know it's carried by mosquitoes. Maybe something we don't know if we look at that. More than 500,000. Most of them are children under the age of 5. So the most vulnerable population, pregnant women and young children. It's carried by a mosquito, the Anopheles mosquito. And the parasite is called a plasmodium. The mosquito, if it has any of the plasmodia in it and they're in the right stage to go in the human, they're up here by the salivary gland. When the mosquito bites the human, some of these plasmodia go into the blood, and there's actually a huge race. Once they start going into the blood, the human immune system recognizes that there's something foreign. The white blood cells go and start trying to engulf these, and there's a race between them. And we can actually see this because we can have videos of the plasmodia that are genetically modified to glow green. And then we can see how these plasmodia go right through, like a car chase in a movie, cells, killing the cells. The white cells go behind them, and they race off into the liver. Once they're in the liver, they hide out here because your immune system around the liver is not very great, because your liver is just like a toxic dump yard. Everything your body doesn't like, it sends to the liver. The liver tries to chemically change it so it can excrete it and get rid of it. So the body doesn't really look out for them. And there they then hide in old dead cells, and they go into the red blood cells. So this is a salivary gland of a mosquito filled with plasmodia, with the parasites that have been genetically modified to glow green. So this is actually an alive mosquito. When a mosquito bites, there are about 20,000 of these parasites in the mosquito. When the mosquito bites, it never releases more than 1,000. Because if it released all of the parasites in one bite, It would be no good. These parasites change the mosquito's metabolism in amazing ways. When these parasites are in the mosquito's intestinal system and they aren't ready yet to go to the human, they make the mosquito feel as if it's full and it doesn't have to bite. As soon as they get ready, they have the different form that's now ready to go into the human. They release some chemicals. Now the mosquito suddenly feels hungry and goes and bites. It can also smell better. So mosquitoes follow different gases, formaldehyde and carbon dioxide. And they follow the plumes of carbon dioxide. So they can actually tell when you're, chemically they can figure out when you're sleeping. Because when you're sleeping, you're breathing out much slower. And so the plumes of carbon dioxide come out of your mouth at a slow rate. So you can actually take carbon dioxide and open it. The mosquito won't come to the carbon dioxide cylinder. But if you open, close, the mosquito will come to the carbon dioxide cylinder. So if they have the plasmodia that's ready to go into the human, they can smell that further away. Then when they come and bite, the first thing they do, they have a painkiller, so we can't feel the proboscis going in. Then the saliva stops the blood from clotting. When the plasmodia are in here, the blood clots immediately. So what happens is the parasite gets into the human, and then it's really not evolutionarily worthwhile for the parasite, for the mosquito to carry on biting there. So the blood clots up, the mosquito is hungry, it goes and bites the next person, and the next person, infecting a whole lot more people than it would normally. And so we can see most of this by following these green fluorescent plasmodia. Again, this is from the cover page of Nature Biotech. One of the main reasons I have it here is for high school audiences. So how do you control malaria? Well, one of the best ways would be to get rid of the Anopheles mosquitoes. There are 5,000 different species of mosquitoes, so if we got rid of just the worst ones, it probably wouldn't be such a big disaster, because other mosquitoes would just take their place in the evolutionary niche, and hopefully they wouldn't carry malaria. So one of the ideas is based on something called sterile insect technique. Has anybody heard of bot flies? No? Bot, B-O-T. So bot flies, they used to be very common in Texas. And they're these ugly little flies that are attracted to open wounds. They'll come to an open wound and they'll lay their eggs in this open wound. The eggs hatch, and the larvae then start feeding on the flesh around the wound. And there are different types. The one that goes on humans, they're actually more complicated. They involve a mosquito. But the ones that involve with cattle, they lay their eggs right in the wound. The bot fly larvae hatch out, and they eat their way into the flesh. And that, of course, means that the cattle, are distressed, and B, the meat is no good anymore. So in the 1950s, this was a big problem in Texas, until somebody found out that bot flies only have sex once and came up with this crazy idea. Well, let's take bot flies and grow up millions of them, kill all the females, and then release the sterile males. What are the sterile males going to do? They're going to try and find females. And they'll find them in the craziest places that we'd never apply any pesticides or anything like that. They'll find the female, mate with the female, but they're sterile, so she's not going to be able to lay any eggs. And she's not going to have sex again because they only have sex once. And so you collapse the whole population. Since the mid-50s, there haven't been any bot flies in America. Most of Central America wiped out as well. In 2011, there was a huge botfly outbreak in Libya. The American military took 10 million sterilized male botflies in these huge big container planes across to Libya, released them, and collapsed the population. Okay, so could we do the same with mosquitoes? Well, yes, they only mate once. So that's a good thing. Problem is, if the mosquito is in this is the larval stage, right, where it's not moving around much, you can't tell the difference between males and females. When it's in the mosquito stage, when it's flying around, you can tell the difference. But you can't actually go and for a million mosquitoes catch it. Female, male. By the way, only the pregnant females bite. They're biting to get hemoglobin from our blood, which they need for the eggs. The males and the non-pregnant females eat nectar. So that wouldn't work. Well, what could we do with GFP? This is where the high school bit comes in. If you look at these larvae, they have two green circles. It's a protein that's only found in the testicles, in the gonads. So these have been genetically modified so that their testicles glow green. And now you can just take a machine that just looks for the green fluorescence, and if it's green fluorescent, oh, it's a male. If it's a female, gets pushed off, and it can actually sort a couple of 100,000 in an hour, just one little machine. And so then the idea is, okay, now if we sterilize those males, we can release them and we can collapse the populations. And so this is being done in an island it turns out a mosquito flies no further than a mile in its whole life. So they're trying to collapse the population on one of these islands in the Caribbean that's not populated, that's quite far away from anything else where there are mosquitoes. Okay, so I got back from my voyage and I thought, wow, it was really fun to go around the world. And in fact, I'm going again on a slightly different route next semester, start in September. Yeah, it's a tough life. But I thought, wow, I've devised all this. I've got to do something out of it. And I thought, well, why not try and write a book about it? So I wrote a book called Illuminating Diseases. And each chapter is a different disease. And so you've seen two little pieces out of that. And then I thought, I'd really like to write a book for high school kids. I actually thought more middle school, but it ended up being for high school kids. So I wrote this book about bioluminescence and things that give off light, and also a bit about how we can use it. And then I have a GFP site. So if you're interested in green fluorescent protein, just search for GFP or green fluorescent protein. The first thing you'll always find is Wikipedia, but the second one you'll always see is my site. And it's got, of course, now it's not only got the advertisement for my first book, but it's got advertisements for the second and third too. But there are all kinds of cool examples that I haven't spoken about. You can see them there. And I'd like to tell you a story. A story about Jelly Belly and the Pretty Boys. I think an aquarium ride is a good place to tell a story about Jelly Belly. So Jelly Belly went to that's Jelly Belly. Jelly Belly went to the school with the Pretty Boys. And I don't know if you have any schools in the aquarium. I haven't seen any. But anyway, they went to school. And the Pretty Boys they weren't nice. They used to make fun of Jelly Belly. They said Jelly Belly wasn't pretty. Jelly Belly didn't have a brain. And it wasn't very nice. One day, they got a new teacher, Mrs. Angler. Mrs. Angler came from the depths of the oceans, where it's very, very dark. And she has this little rod with some bacteria that give off light. And Mrs. Angler said to the class, "Hey, class, tonight we've got to meet. Because you've got to see what it's like where I live, where it's dark." And the Pretty Boys said, "Whoa, Mom says I can't go out at night. I don't know." And they're all very scared. But they go to class at night, and it's really, really dark, and they're all terrified. And Jelly Belly turns on his lights. And they say, "Whoa, I didn't know you could turn on your lights." And Jelly Belly said, "Of course I can. I didn't know you can't. You can't, no, can't." So they thought it was pretty cool. When they got to class, Mrs. Angler, yeah, this is quite a sophisticated class, started telling them about aquarium and about GFP, and she told them about the gene for GFP. You can see they're all very attentive, even the octopus and Rosie, the stone coral. And she told them about something called Brainbow and how we can genetically modify mice's brains to have different colors. And they're all very interested. And so after that, well, you can imagine Jelly Belly was thought to be pretty cool, and they were all much nicer to Jelly Belly. So I had a student who was an art student, and I sort of had the idea of the story, and I went to one of the art professors and said, "Hey, do you have a student that could make some pictures for me, and I'd like to write a children's book?" And she said, "Well, there's Julie McGinley. She's really great." And so one summer, she would make all these drawings. I'd tell her sort of what I'd want, and all her drawings were way, way better than what I have. It's actually 38 images, so I didn't show you all of them. But unfortunately, this is the only one I can't get published. So I always show people the story because I think it's a nice way to end as well. And so this is a story of Jelly Belly and the Pretty Boys.